This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. Coming up in the second half of today's show, aerial arts, as we talk with a dancer who dances 20 feet up in the air. But we are going to start today with a philosopher, Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein. He joins us once a month to talk about philosophical currents. And this time we are going to take a look at the holidays, because there are a lot of them coming up. And of course, at the end of the year now, there have been a lot that have happened all year. Jack, thanks for joining us today.
I'm happy to be here and happy holiday season.
Well, let's start with the idea that holidays have something to do with our collective identity. As a philosopher, how do you think about how much we care about our holidays?
Well, look, there are times in our nation or in our sort of tribes and communities where we are individuals or we are private families. But there are other times when we are a group, we're a cohesive community, where we're, you know, a large integrated whole with lots of working parts. And holidays address those sorts of things. Holidays address the things we have in common, not necessarily the things that we have in difference, right? And so we choose the days, we choose the events, we choose the stories that allow us to communicate and reaffirm what it means to have this, as you referred to, collective identity, the sense that there is a self larger than us that we are a part of, but that's a self that existed before us and that is going to exist after us. And so we're creating a continuity of that identity with the people who initially created the holiday or who did the event and with the people who aren't yet born.
So it is very common for people from the United States to think of themselves as rugged individualists. Should those people not be celebrating holidays?
That's a really good question. And I don't necessarily think that it's about the same thing, right? I mean, a rugged individualist that wouldn't celebrate a holiday might be an anarchist, right? Might be someone who doesn't believe in government at all, doesn't believe in community at all. But what makes a rugged individualist so special in our lore is that they are the foundation of the community. They give us virtues that we should strive for. They offer us a vision of how to help others, how to help yourself, how to set yourself on a path that other people can talk about, right? So no one is a pure individualist. No one, unless you live in, you're a hermit and you live in the woods, right? No one is completely alone. And so what the idea of rugged individualism is this sort of story of what we think the virtuous American should be, but that itself is a collective identity because we have to all assent to it. We have to all agree to it, and then we have to put it in our history books, and we have to put it on our stamps, and we have to talk about it in our television commercials, right? Otherwise, it's just one person's opinion.
Well, let's talk about the one that's coming up this week, Thanksgiving. Very much a big deal in the United States. There is a Thanksgiving in Canada, but it's not anywhere near the, you know, parades and the big football games and the taking the 2 days off to just to recover from how much you ate and then the Black Friday shopping. But then other countries, you know, that just really isn't a day set aside for that. Now, some would argue, well, because they practice it a bit more regularly. But I'm curious, as a philosopher, what do you think the big celebration of Thanksgiving says about this collective identity here?
Well, I think that every culture, every community should have days of Thanksgiving. I think that everyone should take some time and recognize what they are grateful for and to show appreciation for that thing. I mean, life has a lot of negatives. Life is harder than we want it to be. There's always something new around the corner. But at the same time, there's incredible beauty in the world. There's incredible gifts of love and companionship, wonderful food, beautiful vistas, you know, all those sorts of things. And every culture should have a day of Thanksgiving. What we see in the United States is that our official day of Thanksgiving is also wrapped up with the story that we want to tell about our country. It isn't an accurate story. It isn't, you know, factually, you know, precise. It's a mythology that we have. And the mythology is that these people who were lost found a group of people who helped them, taught them, and that they formed a great community that then lasted throughout the centuries. You know, that's a wonderful story. And there's nothing wrong with telling that story. There's nothing wrong with being happy that we are where we are right now and that all of these people participated in it. At the same time, if we really want to be thankful for the community that we're in, we also have to recognize all of the people along the way who didn't fit into that myth, who didn't, you know, receive the benefit of the doubt. And that by telling this story, we are creating a vision for what we want the country to be in the future, even if it isn't now. And I think that that's really important. I think that this period of time – now, I personally love Thanksgiving because I like the food. I like the gathering. I like the social aspect of it. There's no gifts. There's none of that pressure. But at the same time, I also recognize that it's a heavily laden holiday, especially for Native Americans, right, who have suffered under tremendous, injustice for hundreds of years. It's important to acknowledge that too. And I think what people forget when we have debates like this is that you can have more than one emotion at the same time. You can have more than one motivation at the same time. So you can be happy that you're with your friends. You can be grateful for your life while at the same time wishing it were different or acknowledging with sadness or disappointment or even anger the things that happened along the way. When we have these conversations, we tend to have such simplistic views of holidays and of the participants or the celebrants, when in fact, all of this stuff is tremendously complicated. And to really celebrate it, we have to celebrate that complexity.
So is having Native American Heritage Day the day after Thanksgiving enough, or is this lip service?
Well, it's certainly not enough, but that also depends on what you mean by enough, right? I mean, if you mean will having a dedicated holiday towards Native American recognition resolve all of the injustice and suddenly, you know, recognize the treaties that the country has broken, then no, it's not enough. But if what you mean is it good and is it important and should it be celebrated that we are institutionalizing our relationship with Native Americans, with our history with Native Americans, then it's certainly a good start. It's certainly something that should be, you know, acknowledged and again celebrated, because that's the first step, right? If everyone just did that privately, if everyone did that amongst themselves or in their families and they just sort of told stories about Native Americans, that would be important and that would be good. But having the actual recognition from the government, putting it on the calendars, making it a holiday, recognizing that you can, again, like have stamps or coins or posters or television shows about it. Once something is institutionalized, it lasts longer than the participants. And that, again, is the purpose of the holiday, for the events, for the ideas, for the goals, for the history, to outlast those who experience it, outlast those who remembered it, and to communicate from generation to generation, so that we can continue this great narrative that we are all a part of.
What about, we have seen a growing number of communities, sometimes on a city level, sometimes on a state level, but not yet on a national level. Instead of doing Columbus Day, they are celebrating or honoring Indigenous Peoples Day. And a lot of blowback about that. And I'm curious your thoughts on, is this revisionist history and what does that even mean?
So the phrase revisionist history is a really, really good phrase, because it's got two sides of the same coin, right? On the one hand, what revisionist history means is we are telling a story that we haven't told before. We are changing the story. Now, that may seem negative, but often we're changing the story to be more accurate, right? We're changing the story to be more factual. And in that sense, the revisionist history is a good thing. And so the recognition of indigenous peoples to replace Columbus is a recognition of the horrible things that Christopher Columbus did, right? First of all, he didn't discover North America, right? There were plenty of people before him, and there were explorers before him. He was instrumental in genocide. He was instrumental in slavery and rape and corrupting Catholicism in some really important ways. I mean, there's lots of awful stuff. And so I think it's an important acknowledgement to revise the history to be more accurate. At the same time, because we are in a democracy, because so much of our politics is grassroots and starts in communities, it's not going to happen from the top down. You're not just going to wake up one day and the U.S. government is going to say, poof, there's a new holiday. It has to come from the people. And what we're seeing now is, for lack of a better term, a trial run, right? We're seeing here are the communities that are recognizing Indigenous Peoples Day. How many communities are there? How diverse are those communities? Are they urban? Are they rural? Are they north? Are they south? Are they poor? Are they rich? How much is this spreading? And at a certain point, there's going to be enough of a spread, enough of a national distribution that the federal government is going to say, okay, the American people are ready for this. This is what the American people want. Let's make it a federal holiday. And that's probably the way it should work because we live in a democracy and democracy should be bottom up, not top down.
And it is the first time that did really happen with Juneteenth. It was declared a federal holiday this year.
That's right. And Juneteenth is such an interesting holiday because it's an important recognition of the fact that the news of liberation didn't reach everyone it was supposed to, right? So, you know, Juneteenth celebrates when the African Americans in Texas were suddenly told that they were free, even though it happened long after they were freed.
Right.
Now,
years.
What a sophisticated holiday that is, right? And what I mean by that is what a layered story, right? You have the celebration of freedom, but you have a celebration of the imperfection of freedom. You have a celebration of communication, but you also have a celebration that some people are not attended to when they should be. You have the celebration of this culture of a subculture. I don't like that term in the sense, but you know, of the African American community, whatever that means. But you also have a celebration of the fact that they are a part of American and they are American citizens and they are equal to all other ethnic or racial groups. And so what's super interesting about Juneteenth is that it is by definition an incredibly layered, complex, sophisticated holiday that necessitates a conversation that maybe Thanksgiving doesn't really inspire anymore because we're just so used to it that we take it for granted.
Is it a federal holiday if it's not a paid day off?
Well, you know, it not by definition. You know, I mean,
but I mean, there are layers to this federal holiday thing.
Sure.
Some of them are paid days off, and this one's not.
Right. And a lot of that has to do with, you know, does it happen on a Monday or a Friday, right? You know, are they going to want to sell cars on that day? You know, I mean, that's a public policy decision. And the government, as the policymaker, is always going to be the moral leader, the mentor, the guidepost. And so if the government says, well, this is a super important holiday, but we're not going to give you a day off, then that's going to set the tone for everyone else. But if the government says, well, we're going to give you a day off, then that communicates to everyone else that this is really important. This is so important that we're paying people to celebrate it. And I think that's a matter of opinion, and I think that that's a matter of your vision of the world, your sense of politics, your sense of the importance of work versus play. And of course, right now, with all of the tensions in our nation, with especially the racial tension in our nation, it also is a message as to, you know, how we expect ourselves to move forward. And so I can see both arguments, but I myself personally would happily take more paid off vacations, you know. Keep giving them to me. I'm happy to take them.
Well, you said about Juneteenth and about Columbus Day, there is this invitation for conversation and a deeper understanding of why this day is set aside. And I'm wondering if really some of this is just a matter of semantics of what we name something, because a holiday sounds like a joyous festival thing. And you can make the argument that holidays are about celebrating an ideal, but we wouldn't say something like Holocaust Remembrance Holiday. This is a remembrance. This is a much more somber occasion. What about this idea that maybe we just don't call these things holidays and we call them remembrances?
There is a case to be made that the words that you use set the tone. And I think the examples that you're giving are really helpful, right? I mean, Thanksgiving holiday is for eating. July 4th holiday is for barbecuing. Holocaust Remembrance Day is for reflection and for meditation.
Yeah.
But in order to really understand what's going on, I think we have to look at the 20th century writ large, right? Up until the 1950s, up until actually the early 1960s, we had this sense of what gets called American exceptionalism, that we talked about America and its holidays in fairly two-dimensional ways, and it was dominated by Christian visions, and it was dominated by white visions, and it was dominated largely by Protestant visions. And then during, you know, the various different cultural revolutions in the 1960s, what the voices said was, these holidays that you claim are happy are not actually happy holidays, right? That Thanksgiving is not a happy day, that July 4th is not a day of simple celebration, that everything we do in this country is complex and laden and wrapped up in the best of us and the worst of us. And so ever since that shift in the 1960s, we have had to contend culturally with the fact that a two-dimensional celebration is not an accurate reflection of our history. And so I say that because on the one hand, I think your division of holiday versus Remembrance Day is an important one and helps set the tone for what we want to do that day. But on the flip side, the counter voices, the folks who are fighting for various different visions of justice, what they're saying is there's no such thing as a holiday in the sense that you're articulating. There's no such thing as a purely happy day. Everything has victims. Everything has paths not taken. And we can celebrate the good, but we also have to recognize the bad. And the legacy of that shift in the mid-60s has driven so much discourse in our culture that you know, it's 50 years later and we are still, mm-hmm. you know, we're still having this conversation on the radio.
You know, in your answer, you said happy holidays, and that has very much become one of those words that can make certain people kind of angry, and they're saying that you're taking the religiousness out of the holidays of this time of year, of you know, celebrating the birth of Christ. What's interesting to me about that is holidays is sort of a contraction of holidag, and it meant holy days. And I'm wondering, is getting mad at somebody saying holidays the same as getting mad at somebody who says can't instead of cannot?
Well, you know, okay, so I think I'm going to say something that's probably more controversial than maybe I want it to be. But there was a discussion a few weeks ago about vaccine mandates, and there was a hospital down south that said, okay, if you are going to refuse the vaccine for religious reasons, then you also have to refuse Tylenol. You have to refuse all of these things. If you go back similarly to discussions about conscientious objectors in the Vietnam War, you couldn't just believe that violence was wrong. You had to be part of a religious denomination that saw violence as wrong, and you had to have it formalized. I use those examples to say, if what you are saying is, I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to be a capitalist and I'm going to celebrate all of the secular stuff, but I want you to say Merry Christmas because it's a religious holiday, I just don't believe you. Right. I think that's a political argument. I think that's a partisan battle. And what you're really doing is saying, I'm a Republican or I'm a Democrat and I want you to be a Republican or you to be a Democrat. But if you are a profoundly religious person, if your Christmas day is spent at church, really worshiping, if you're there the night before for midnight mass, if you are really praying at your meals, if you're doing all of these things, then it's a holy day. But otherwise, it's just another holiday. It's just another day that we take off, that we get to be with our family, that we think of other people and buy gifts. And I don't think those things are bad. When I say it's just another, I don't mean to diminish that, but it's not a holy day. And if it's a real holy day, then you have to recognize that other people have real holy days too, right? That other people have their own religions. And you can decide that you are offended by people not acknowledging your religiosity. You can also decide not to acknowledge other people's religiosity. That's all fair game, because we're allowed to be offended by what we're offended by. We're allowed to want other people to do things that they necessarily won't do. But if the argument is that it is a holy day, then I, as a philosopher, am going to say, okay, show me how you've made it holy. Show me how you have committed yourself to the religious vision of this and engaged in the religious rituals and intertwined the spirituality holistically in you. Otherwise, it's just another bumper sticker. And I think that that's really important, because that's the difference between the communal aspect and the private aspect. In our culture, ideally, religion is a private matter. And so if you want to have a holy day, in general, it's a private act between you and your family, between your family, you and your house of worship, and all of that's fine. And if even if you're evangelical, it's still a private matter. It's just a private matter you're trying to recruit other people for. Christmas as a sort of commercial holiday, that's not private, that's public. And we know that because there's decorations everywhere, and there's, you know, horrible songs on the radio, and there's, you know, Christmas in the Park in Grand Forks. And none of that is private, and none of that is religious. So I don't necessarily, or rather, none of that is authentically religious. And so if someone says it's a holy day, I want to see evidence that they're making it holy in their actions and in their beliefs.
What do you mean by authentically religious? Why do you get to decide what that means?
Well, I certainly don't decide it, but authentically religious does not mean pure in any way, right? So interestingly enough, Buddhism didn't have statues of Buddha until the Alexander the Great brought Greek and Hellenistic culture to that part of the world. The Christmas tradition is pagan in its roots because Jesus wasn't born in December, right? So there's nothing that pure. What authentically religious means is that when you practice it, you act from a religious perspective, from a religious point of view, and that it represents your true beliefs insofar as you see them. And so it's not so much that I'm deciding whether someone is authentically religious, but I am, as a philosopher, defining what authentic means in that context, which is it is really about their own personal, honest spirituality, and their behaviors reflect that, as opposed to something more public, something more commercial, something more superficial.
Philosopher Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein, thanks for your time.
A pleasure as always.
Still to come on Main Street, aerial dancing. But first, this news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. North Dakota reported 118 overdose deaths in 2020. That's a 49% increase from 2019, when 79 deaths were reported. The director of the Behavioral Health Division of the State Human Services Department says her division has a number of strategies to try and get that number of overdose deaths down. Pam Sagna says one strategy is to help people get the treatment they need, but she says that is a challenge.
Some of the most effective treatments for opioid use disorder, it's methadone. And in North Dakota, those opioid treatment programs are only located in three of our primary cities. And so individuals can drive many, you know, hundreds of miles, you know, in a week or in a day, just accessing that vital medication every day.
Sagnus says the department is now working on expanding treatment availability.
We have some funding out to expand those services into other areas like Grand Forks and in the West, and so we're very optimistic that we'll see better access to those medications and to those treatment programs.
Nationally, overdose deaths topped the 100,000 mark in 2020. The process of resettling dozens of Afghan refugees in North Dakota continues. Dan Hanaher is field director for Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Service, North Dakota.
To date, we will have received 23, all with either family ties or friend ties. It's what we call U.S. ties. So they're all being welcomed by people that they know, either from family or friendship, and are resettling into mostly the Fargo area, although we have had an individual settle in Lisbon and another in Gwinner. But it's moving rapidly, but so far smoothly.
North Dakota is expected to see a total of 49 Afghan evacuees. Hanaher says with the thousands of job openings here, employment opportunities are a blessing. He says employers are chomping at the bit to find workers, and the businesses he has talked with are well aware of the quality of work of the new arrivals. And the head of the Minnesota Retail Association says merchants are largely optimistic about strong holiday sales. Bruce Newstead says consumers have already signaled higher demand and shippers are straightening out kinks in the supply chain.
Consumer concern over the supply chain is definitely fueling earlier shopping. Now, an interesting piece is that for those that have experienced some supply chain slowage, they're actually now getting stuff that they ordered back in May, June, July. You know, you may order something in May, June, July, thought you were going to get it in July, August, September, October. Now it turns out you're actually getting some of that product October, November, December. So I think we're seeing a little bit of that supply chain level off.
Newstead says retailers expect more in-store shopping than last year when the pandemic kept many people at home. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by United Way of Cass Clay, bringing our community together, lifting families out of poverty, and creating a better tomorrow for all of us. When we believe united, we succeed united. Learn more at UnitedWayCassClay.org. For 40 years, Prairie Public has been on the radio, bringing you NPR news and regional journalism from reporters who call North Dakota home. We've also been your source for music discovery and companionship, as well as quality, non-commercial programming. Today, Prairie Public is also on your smartphone and smart speaker. Help keep this tradition going for another 40 years and beyond by becoming a sustaining member today. Just go to prairiepublic.org and open the red link that says Donate.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. Dancing is hard. You have to be strong, flexible, and graceful all at the same time. Now, add to that being suspended 20 feet in the air. At the recent Chris Kindle Market, I caught up with Yvette Reyes, the owner and studio director of FM Aerial and Movement Arts.
What is FM Aerial and Movement Arts?
Oh my goodness, it has grown so much. What is it now? Okay, so FM Aerial, we teach aerial arts classes. They are silks and lyra currently. We are hoping to add extra, like, classes in the future, but that's kind of what our teachers specialize right now. And the movement arts, we teach pole dance, twerk classes, and also just a variety of, like, what people are like, we want to use a space. I'm like, yeah, use our space. Like, if we don't have a class going on, I want to see what you come up with.
So aerial arts, for anyone who doesn't know, this means up in the air, like the word aerial does. And silks, you're talking, these are those long strands of fabric that dancers are twirling themselves up in and dancing 20 feet high in the sky?
Yes, yes. Tonight we just danced 20 feet in the air. In Fargo, silks are commonly referred to as the ribbon dancing or the curtain dancing, I've heard from a lot of people.
Is that specific to Fargo?
I think it's because I live in Fargo that it's like, I ask people and they're like, oh, is it the curtains? And I'm like, this would be a very long conversation, so yes.
Okay. They kind of look like curtains. I can see that.
Much stronger. Much stronger.
Okay, good to know. Yes. Good to know. Yeah, what do you need to consider with this fabric here? Because I imagine you can't just do this on wool.
Yes, no.
That would be terrible.
Yes, or in the basement of your house. Yes. You'd be surprised. There are quite a few people that are very excited, and this makes a lot of sense because it is a very, like, unique art form, and it is really great for just general, like, keeping your body limber. But at the same time, there are a lot of considerations with aerial arts that I feel like people don't know about because the information wasn't very readily available silks and aerial is still a very new art form, so maybe within like the past 100 years that it's been around. So when considering like doing silks, it's very much like what are you rigging to? Like, what is the structure that you are attaching yourself to? Can it take the force of a human being that is doing dynamic movements? Our body can create up to 3 times like our body weight by doing simple movements. So that's something of like, can it hold like 2,000 pounds worth of force, basically. It is not like 300 pounds. It is like in the thousands.
Wow.
Yes. And often like your homeowner's insurance will void your insurance as well if you do have any kind of like this thing in your basement too. So please be careful. Please don't do it in your home. Take classes. Like, they're available now. And we would love to teach people.
Did you grow up a dancer?
I guess, maybe. Like, I grew up dancing in my room with a mirror.
Okay, solid.
So, like, YouTube, homecoming dance moves, the top 10, where you're just wiggling around. Like, that's kind of my education in dance.
Okay. Well, is that the right term to use? Are you a dancer? Are you a yogi? Are you an athlete? Are you something totally different?
I would say, so kind of a myriad of different things. I definitely a dancer. I enjoy dancing. Dancing brings me a lot of joy. But I'm also so many different wings, I suppose. I feel like human beings are very fluid. And so you can be like a yogi 1 year and then the next year be like, I haven't done yoga in like 6 months. So do I still consider myself a yogi?
So. Well, being fluid seems like a handy sort of personality, mindset, what have you, to doing something like this. What are the other skill sets that you need to have to be able to tie yourself up loosely, because you're also rolling yourself down from this little piece of fabric? Sure, stronger than a curtain, but it's still a piece of fabric that you are only loosely tied into, so that you can, you know, kick yourself into the splits or a big back bend, and you're crawling up it and you're rolling down. Are you a little bit crazy?
Yes, absolutely. Who would do this willingly? Who would put themselves in dangerous positions just because? But it is not. So I feel that oftentimes, like, it comes across as very, like, precarious situations that you put yourself in, and it can be very dangerous. And that is why we always use like mats. I went through teacher training and they had me videotape my setup. And they're like, we will accept you into our training if you buy a thicker mat, because mine were 2-inch, and they were like, you need at least 4 to 8.
Okay.
And I was like, ooh, that is $500.
So, yeah. This is, don't put a yoga mat under you. This is...
Yes. Yoga mats are for yoga.
Yeah.
But it's very much like logic, too. So it is the building blocks of how can you, like, put yourself in these different situations of like knots. How can you wrap your feet in certain ways? How can you like wrap your body? And over time it starts to make a lot more sense, because there are patterns that you start to find. And so if you're somebody that gets really bored doing the same repetitive motions, fabrics, silks, aerial arts, and pole, like, they're all very similar in that you can add so much. Like, you can go so many different ways because you have not just the technicality, but also the artistic form of, like, how do I want to express myself today? How does this song make me feel? Like, what can I use with my fingertips, with my shoulders, with my free leg? How can I use even my sight to, like, guide my body? So it's very much of, like, a world of exploratory movement. That's and then you're really sweaty at the end, and you're like, wow. And then you're strong.
Yeah, you're very strong.
Thank you. It has been, so I've been training for, I want to say, almost 6 years now. So it's been almost 6 years. I started with pole dance, and in pole we start from the ground. So we start you with at least 1 foot on the ground. It is, I call it sneaky exercise, because you're
it's
doing...
It's like playing.
Yeah, exactly. You're playing. Like, you're learning how to do spins, you're learning how to climb. And over time, those movements really develop, like, the smaller muscles in your body, like your rotator cuffs and your hip flexors, and they build you up to be able to do bigger movements, and also cleaner movements. So slowing everything down, finding a full straddle. Yes. And then it's just doing it so many times that your body does develop like strength over mm-hmm. time, but it's not like I'm going to the gym and I'm going to like, the gym is great too. Like if that's your thing, that's amazing. My supervisor, he goes to the gym for 2 hours every day and he cannot touch his hands behind his back. Like he would scratch his back by like rubbing it on like a piece of
real?
Metal. At the shop. Frank, I love you. So,
yeah. Wait, this was somebody who was teaching you how to do aerial dance?
No. So this is working as a welder, he's my supervisor. Yeah.
So you are a welder besides?
So I was, yes. I was a welder.
Okay.
Yes, as of 2 weeks ago, I quit my full-time welding job in the shop that I've been at for 6 years to pursue the art of FM aerial and movement arts. So.
Okay. Well, speaking of being fluid and being brave, you quit a full-time job.
This is terrifying. Yeah. People who own businesses are insane.
They're insane. Okay. How'd your business do during COVID?
So I wanted to close, if I'm to be totally honest. Yeah. I honestly thought I was going to shut it down. I had already made a plan of like where I was going to be, I was still going to do aerial arts mm-hmm. and pole, but I had a different mindset of like how to pursue that. My landlord is actually really kind and helpful, and thankfully I was working as a welder and we were considered essential workers, so I was working full time at the shop, so I was able to pay for both my living expenses and the business. So we lost, yes, it hit us really hard, but not as hard as if we were in Minnesota. Mm. So it was, but also really scary when things opened up too, because we were mm-hmm. like, we didn't know when it was going to happen. And then all of a sudden you're open and the landlord's like, aren't you happy? And I'm like, I don't know. Like, I didn't have a plan. Not having a plan is really terrifying. So maybe.
What got you interested in welding?
Okay. Wow. This might be a really long story. Okay, so short story. money, because... Well, yes. So one-word story, money. I needed money. I could not afford to go... I applied early decision to Mount Holyoke in the Eastern Coast, yeah. which was the first women's college in the USA. But I did not calculate the finances right, and so I ended up having to withdraw because even though they were giving me a lot of financial aid and grants, I could not take out loans and I didn't have the money to go to school. So my family sat me down and they're like, you can't go to this college. And it was already too late to apply to other places. So I withdrew my acceptance and I did a Google search and I was like, what has the highest placement rate with a living wage? And welding was like the first one. I was like, welding it is. I didn't know what it was. I didn't know that you had to plug stuff in and it used electricity. I started myself on fire, like a full flames. But I mean, I did it, had a full-time job, didn't sleep very much. Yep, got a job. I mean, the week after I moved to Fargo and was working. I mean, yeah. I moved to Moorhead with my family and mm-hmm. then was working in West Fargo.
Are there a lot of women in welding?
When I left, there were two other women on my shift, which is night shift. On days, there is, I want to say, one woman.
So out of how many people?
Out of many people. Many okay. people. 30, 50.
Wow.
So, yeah, it is. There's not very many women. I mean, I think it's because maybe people are afraid to, like, take up welding.
Well, you did set yourself on fire.
I set myself on fire a few times.
A few times.
I definitely hurt myself a few times, almost squished myself, like, two or three times.
Uh-huh.
So, like, yes, it is dangerous. It can be dangerous.
Yeah. And you left that to go dance 20 feet in the air on fabric. Okay,
yes.
Gotcha.
Yeah, what? The danger factor. What?
You like adrenaline, huh?
I mean, I didn't think I did, but looking at my choices, I'm like, maybe.
Maybe this is a thing for you.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, in what ways are those two professions similar, besides maybe the rush?
Similar. I guess, honestly, welding is... It is an art form in the sense that you have to be very in tune with your body. Like, you actually do, because you have to be very in control of your breath. when you're welding, you have to be like control your inhale and exhales, because if you don't, your weld looks really wobbly. You have to be super controlled arm movements. You have to be able to be in a supported spot to be able to weld. Otherwise, if anything happens to your weld, you have to cut it out, and that really sucks. And I have asthma, so I really try not to cut stuff out. Maybe I should have done a Google search on what careers not to have when you have asthma. So.
Oh, I don't even know where to go from here.
My mom was really happy when I quit the welding. She was like, you won't have to go to the ER every year anymore.
Every year?
Just about, yeah. Okay. Honestly, I think it was welding, and I had too many hamsters, and they kind of overpowered me. So.
I'm sorry, what did you just say?
I had too many hamsters. I had 3 hamsters, and that was too much for my immune system, I guess. Like, my throat closed, and I had to drive myself to the ER. It was really sad. And then they were like cannibals, so they ate each other. So it was even worse.
Did I miss anything? This went a lot of directions. It's only been 15 minutes.
I feel like this is every single time I talk to anybody, there's so many tangents. So I guess something that is kind of interesting that I would like to kind of touch on is, so I guess two things. One of the things is, so I guess something that kind of sets our studio apart, or at least something that I'm really passionate about, is the idea of like explorative movement, but also the idea of the art form. So when I think of aerial arts and pole dance and all of like the dancing aspect, it's not very, the focus is not to lose weight and it's not to be fit. So if that's like what the goal is, like it's not something that we talk about in the studio. So when you come to the studio, it's going to be very much like, what do you do? What are your interests? Like what kind of like makes you excited as a person, and then we're gonna do really hard like and then we're gonna leave feeling like really great. But it's very much about like being like, who is coming in the studio, because I'm really interested in like meeting people, because I think people have a lot of potential and are very interesting. Like, I'm so interested to see like the different personalities that come in, because we've been getting a lot of very assertive personalities recently that I'm like, ooh, this is very interesting. I'm like, I really like where this is going. So we'll do like short choreographies, and then people will add their own like flair to it, which is really cool to see. Because I don't want people to just be like robotic in the sense of like, show me how you do things, and I'm going to do them exactly the way that you teach me. It's more of like, okay, your body is safe, in the sense that like, your movements are coming from a place that you understand. So the way that you move your shoulders and your hips, everything is in alignment. But now you can take it a step further by adding your own, like, your own signature to it. So, like, how are you expressive? It's very expressive. And that's something that I really enjoy.
You know, a minute ago you used the word assertive. And I'm thinking back to the beginning of the conversation that you said you also are teaching a twerking class and teaching on pole. And these are types of dances that I think it's safe to say most of society looks down on. And I'm just curious, do you think that is something of just like, okay, it's not beautiful like ballet, or, you know, it's not respectable like ball dancing? Or do you think that it could have something to do with, we still don't like female agency and females who are fine with their sexuality and putting out whatever they want?
Yes, I have so many thoughts. Yes, it is, because there's definitely a stigma, especially like around pole, because that's what I started with. And then there was this whole thing of like hashtag not a stripper, where people were distinguishing themselves. They're like, no, this is pole fitness, it's not what they do in the club. And so I think this kind of stems from like society and society's like view on women, and also like using shame as a tactic to like control like like women's actions. And so I find that surrounding topics of like body is very, it's very sensitive because it's something that's not very open. Mm. And so when you come into a pole class, like you have to wear shorts and like basically like a sports bra because you're not going to be able to stick on the pole. It's going to be very frustrating because the fabric just makes it so much harder. You need the friction of your skin. And also with like twerking, like you have to wear loose shorts because otherwise your butt doesn't move. And so you can't get the movements down. But also being able to like go through these movements and be like, okay, so this is how this is how my body is. Getting in tune with the way that your body looks and also an awareness and then an appreciation of like, it's okay. Like I'm okay. And it's okay to be a sexual person. Like, yes, it is an asexual person. It's not something that we talk about like outright. It's not like, okay, today we have a seminar on our sexuality. but it kind of, it's underneath because it is. What you're wearing kind of comes up these ideas of like, am I comfortable with my body? And unfortunately, I see there's a lot of people that are not. And this is why, as a studio owner, like I try to make the space more receptive to people that are maybe not super confident yet, but will get there. Because I've definitely seen the transformation of people coming in and being like very like, I'm going to wear yoga pants, a tank top, and extra so many layers and like biker shorts, and then seeing them like really come into like being like, no, I'm okay because I know that I need this. It's not about how my body looks. It's about like what my body can do, and my body is really strong now. And then they take that confidence and they put it to work at like at work or in their relationships, and they're like, I feel much better in my own skin. And I think that's really cool. So at the studio, if you come to the studio for pole, like the lights are dim, we have like black lights, and it's very much the focus is on like your movement versus like how you look. Like it's about what's inside. Yes.
Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you. I really appreciate you.
That was Yvette Reyes, the owner and studio director at FM Aerial and Movement Arts. You can find out more at fmaerial.com. Dakota Datebook is next.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
Republicans won big in Virginia just a year after the state swung for President Biden. Some voters there say it's time for Democrats to get more aggressive.
They're too busy playing defense and trying to be nice. Because this culture war is not going to end because you refuse to participate.
How can the party recover ahead of next year's midterm elections? On the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
There's 5 hours of Morning Edition every weekday here on Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Datebook for November 22nd. We will never know the full extent of the 1918 flu pandemic in North Dakota. The virus hit the state at a time of poor public health administration with no state health department. The official death count of 1,378 people is almost certainly an undercount. One estimate in recent years put the death toll at more than 5,100 North Dakotans. The so-called Spanish flu slammed into North Dakota in the fall of 1918, in the final weeks of World War I. Newspapers reported on public facilities being closed, among other restrictions. They also reported on the daily flu cases and deaths. A Morton County judge who had served a decade in office died from the flu while seeking re-election. The editor of the Lisbon Gazette also caught the flu. She died in 3 days. She had served as an editor for over a year while her husband was overseas in the war. Healthcare workers also died. Doctors from Harvey, Lansford, Laverne, and Marmouth. Nurses, too, whether serving the war effort overseas or helping with the pandemic at home. The Florence Kimball Post No. 7 in Lisbon honors one of those nurses. The 24-year-old died in France while serving with the Army Nurse Corps. She was buried with full military honors in the Serena American Cemetery. Many of the dead from the flu were soldiers. handful of American Legion posts in North Dakota are named in honor of soldiers lost to the pandemic. On this date in 1918, the Zap area had its eighth flu death, and the North Dakota Agricultural College in Fargo experienced the first death of a female student. She was 17 years old. The flu pandemic death toll in North Dakota was a tragic loss. Most victims were between the ages of 20 and 40. They were young men and women, newlyweds, parents, students, soldiers. Many city and county history books, written decades after 1918, have little mention of the pandemic beyond who died from it. Today's historians have wondered if the memories were just too painful to recount. One state government report summed up the pandemic like this: "During this period, we have been visited by the worst epidemic, perhaps, the world has ever known." Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Jack Dura. I'm Marie Offutt.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
You love hearing the little birdie, followed by a great story. Now read all about it again. Dakota Datebook, North Dakota Stories from Prairie Public, Volume 2 is out, and if you order now, you'll get it in time for the holidays. Meet Mustache Maud, the only woman convicted of cattle rustling in the United States. Learn about the whale that made its way across this very landlocked state. Read about homesteaders, earthquakes, meteors, crazy capers, and misguided criminals, and much more. It's our state's colorful and untold history in one beautifully laid out collection. Order the new book, Dakota Datebook, North Dakota Stories from Prairie Public, Volume 2, for $24.95 each at prairiepublic.org.
That's it for this Monday edition of Main Street. Coming up tomorrow on the show, Coming to America, a story of leaving Nazi-occupied Poland and Germany and coming to a life of farming in Midwest America. That's coming up tomorrow on Main Street. Until then, enjoy the rest of your day.